On the 26th of May, 1850, Mr. E. Pickus respectfully submitted the first minutes of this congregation. Written in German, in ink, on minute books which we still prize here at the temple, they record the circumstances through which and under which the Prayer of Israel came into being. Some 45, 48 men and their families had met that day. They passed the following resolution. I quote from the minutes. The meeting was called by Mr. A. Schwab, the home of S. Loeb, to draw up rules for the new congregation under the name of Tiferet Israel. Dr. Isidore Kalish, liberal and scholarly rabbi who had left the old congregation with our seceding group, informed us that in case he was chosen, he would accept the position of spiritual leader, preacher, and teacher, only on condition that the members assured him that they would attend services every Friday evening and Saturday morning. A vote was taken, and the congregation agreed. Alibi. Our congregation came into being because these 48 men and their families were somewhat restive under the rather traditional and conservative leadership or umbrella of the then single existing congregation in Cleveland. They felt that the New Age, the 1850s, required a new approach to the traditional faith. Such was our beginning, the beginning of 120 years of growth and service. As you know, when happiness occurs in our families, when we enjoy a simcha, we want to wish one another a Me'av Esrim. May you live to be 120. 120 is taken to be the extreme outer limit of an individual's life. Well, we've reached 120. What then? We go on. Because unlike individuals, institutions, congregations measure their life, their birth, their growth by another chronological standard. I have worshipped in Tiberias in Israel in a synagogue which has been in constant use for 4 centuries. And I'm told that in the Yemen and in Egypt, there have been congregations which have been open and at the business of Judaism for nearly 1,000 years. Congregations are not immortal. They are born, they grow, and they die. But their lifespan can be, if they are fortunate, and it requires mazel, their lifespan can be long indeed. But they are not immortal, and we should not assume that because we have grown and waxed strong, and because God has established the work of our hands, therefore we will grow and wax stronger, and God will continue to establish the work of our hands. In the last 40 years alone, 10,000 synagogues in Europe have ceased to be, and perhaps half that number in the Arab Middle East and in Arab North Africa. For every synagogue that was in being the day this congregation was formed, 100 congregations have ceased to be in the intervening period. So much has this sense of the transiency of Jewish life in part of our life, so much as oppression and persecution and forced exile and the burning of synagogues been part of our history, that when our people, when the folk, came to paint the messianic image, the glorious picture of the golden days at the end of days, imagined to themselves that at that time all of the synagogues where they had once congregated, the places they had loved, that these places would somehow suddenly, miraculously materialize again. And they would find themselves again, not in their scattered dispersion, but in Israel. The doors of each synagogue would be open wide, and the hymns of our people would be heard again inside. And many a Hasid, many of the Hasidim who came from Eastern Europe in the last 20 or 30 years, who came from there to Israel, brought with them in their pockets a key, the key to the Beit HaMidrash, the key to the Beit HaKnesset, the key to their school, their ski to their shul, so that they would be prepared to open the door which had been locked shut when they had been forced into exile. Many of you have been to Newport, Rhode Island. You've seen there the beautiful wooden white clapboard Revolutionary Times synagogue, which is the oldest extant synagogue in colonial America. Now, why does it exist today? It exists today in part because the congregation that thrived there in the 18th century no longer thrived there in the 19th century, because Newport, once the center of trade in New England, ceased to be that center in trade, and the plans for the enlargement of this very beautiful little box were never carried through. And the Newport downtown did not grow high and simply overwhelm this congregation. It remains a monument because the economics, the politics of the time took Newport from the front rank of American towns and made it a backwater. Drive from Cleveland into the Ohio countryside. Drive through any of the great Midwestern states and you'll find small town after small town where there are synagogues, small buildings built in the 1880s and the 1890s, built by men and women as committed as those who created this congregation, as determined to serve God as any of our founders, who established in their town with high hopes the civil synagogue. But the hopes of the town were not fulfilled. And today the young have left these towns, and many of these synagogues have closed the doors, and many more will in the near future. The success of a congregation depends in large measure upon the economic and political context of the community in which it has established itself. Mr. Silver and I visited in Calcutta in January of this year. We were taken to see the grand Sephardic congregation in the downtown of Calcutta. It sits on one of the busiest corners of the city. It's a great building, three stories high, capable of seating many hundreds at worship. The ark, as in many Oriental synagogues, is not a cabinet for the scrolls of the law, but a walk-in room with ledges on which the Sephardim put their great filigreed Torah cases, these wonderful cases in which their Torah scrolls were kept. There were 50 such cases in this ark. And we were shown the book which the congregation had printed for its centennial 15 years ago. It was a book full of a proud record of past accomplishment and full of high hopes for the future. We were told that the congregation was going to enlarge the building. I read that the congregation was going to refurbish the sanctuary and that they were going to gild the face of the altar. And I was also told that 5 years ago, only 10 years after this centennial, so full of hope, Neveh Tzedek, this Sephardic grand synagogue, had closed its doors and that worship had been moved for the few who remained in Calcutta to a small room on the top floor of an apartment. Ech naflu hagiborim. How quickly do the mighty fall. When a town falls on anarchy, political anarchy, or economic bad times, when Jews must leave or do leave, they leave behind many of the hopes of other generations. For a congregation is nothing more really than the commitment of the Jews who live in a community at the moment. We cannot build for an eternal future. We do not control that future. and only build for today and do what must be done now for us, by us, for us and for our children. Now, at this point, it would be usual to move from this conversation about the transitoriness of congregational life to a sermonic encouragement of high civic commitment. To say to you, well, congregations depend upon the well-being of their communities. Let's each of us commit himself in the next decade or so to a larger citizenship. And of course, that larger citizenship is needed. We must be involved, as this congregation has always been involved, in the concerns of welfare and civil rights, concerns with amenity and decency in Cleveland, the concerns of economic prosperity and economic justice. Jeremiah wrote a letter to the first exiles, the first of the dispersed, the first of the many, some 2,800 years ago. And he said in that letter to the Judeans who've been carried away captive by Nebuchadnezzar and his Babylonian cohorts, he said then something which can be said today as well, as has been true for all times in the diaspora. Seek ye the peace of the community wherein thou hast been carried. Pray for her peace. Ki vishlomecha tiyer lahem shalom, for in her peace shall ye find your peace. The prosperity, the progress, the justice, the opportunity, the decency of life in Cleveland will in large measure determine the success, the prosperity, the quality of life of our congregation. But I wonder if this kind of sermon really satisfies the needs of the hour. It must be said, consider it said. Each of us must be far more energetic for righteousness and justice and peace than we have been heretofore. But I wonder why so many sit quietly and do not see the urgency of the hour. Why is there Mr. Nixon's silent majority? And I believe that there is a silent majority, and I wonder about the silence. What is silence? A folding of the hands, a timidity, an unwillingness to brave new ways, to try new forms of economic or social or political organization, to give up one's security, the narrow parameters of self and family and work and recreation, and to reach out to a broader kind of living, where one may even have to change the entire direction of his life or change the forms in which his thinking has usually taken place. I wonder why so many sit silent, why they have eyes but they see not, and ears, but they hear not. And I suspect that there are two main reasons, and each of these reasons, in a sense, establishes what I believe to be the focus, the presumed necessary focus of our congregational life in the years immediately ahead. The first is this, that most congregations have assumed that they preach love, that they preach sympathy, empathy, one of these vague human terms to which we all react affirmatively, but which are not hard terms, specific terms, which each of us interprets necessarily within his own preconditioning, within the terms of his experience. Take a middle-class congregation in a middle-class suburb with middle-class people, decent, fine people. Talk to them of love, talk to them of sympathy, talk to them of empathy, and they will interpret what you say in terms of their own experience, which is a limited experience, which is always an experience of the last 10 years, not of the next 10 years. The great virtue of our Jewish tradition is that it is hard. And it is specific. It has a halakha. It has had a specific listing of rules and regulations, of disciplines. It has wrestled concretely with the problems of the day. And if we encounter this tradition in its fullness, if we cease to preach platitudes, if we cease to teach platitudes, if we cease to be satisfied with platitudes and look at the hard reality, what does justice mean 1970? What does it mean in respect to Huff? What does it mean in respect to busing in Shaker Heights? What does it mean in respect to the move to the exurbs? What is justice for the labor union man? What is justice for the businessman? What is justice for the student? What is justice for the university? If we examine these specific problems, confront them from a rich and specific tradition, we bring not encouragement but insight, not simply passion, but wisdom. This is a passionate age, full of people surging after causes. But passion, dear friends, is not enough. Passion must be wise and full of understanding. It must seek concrete ends which can realistically be achieved. It must have concrete goals which are for the good of the many, and not only for the good of the group surging, seeking, crusading for a particular end. Our congregations must grow up to our school children and adult education in worship the rich variety of our moral and ethical tradition, the halakha, and each of us must, in a sense, react to it. We must have here not simply the short-term courses where of an evening a lecturer presents to us one interesting sly insight into the tradition, the kind of disciplined, continuous learning where we search and seek and expose ourselves to the tradition and wrestle with it until we come to some better understanding of the world in which we live. Why do men have eyes but they see not and ears but they hear not? Sociology and psychology have anything to teach us, it is simply this, that each of us is in a sense timid. We prefer security to insecurity, the familiar to the unknown. None of us wants to admit really that the way we walk is symbolized in our Bible by the wilderness road, the unknown, the uncertain, the unmarked. Each of us prefers to believe that there are clear signposts, that we walk as our fathers did walk, that the way is known to us, and what is familiar to us today, we will be able to continue to do tomorrow and the day after. And so we have defense mechanisms, and so we have all kinds of ways of denying to ourselves what is obvious to some, particularly to the young who are not yet bound to their securities. We have ways of denying to ourselves the radical uncertainty of life, what life is really like. It would like to believe that we can put on our backs the small virtues and the bit of wisdom that we have, and that this is food sufficient, sustenance sufficient for the long haul. It is not. Particularly so in our day, the day so full of a convulsion, so full of change. And yet each of us prefers to believe that the world is not a maelstrom, that the degree of change, the rapidity of change, the radical nature of change is not as speedy or as radical as we are constantly being told it is. We do what we have always done in the happy, foolish hope that this will be enough, and that in any case we are impotent, we are one in several billion, what more can we do? Well, here too, it seems to me, a congregation 1970 has a unique responsibility. The paradigm I would place before you is that of Jacob wrestling with the unknown assailant, the angel, through the long night. We call ourselves the children of Israel. Israel, Jacob's second name. How did he gain the name Israel? He had wronged his brother. He had fled from the ancestral home. He had been in exile, self-imposed exile, for 14 years. Suddenly the tug of family came upon him. He felt the need to return, to make peace with his brother. He wasn't certain his brother would accept him. He sent his brother peace offerings, gifts, bribes. He still was not certain. And yet his feet carried him towards the fatal meeting. He came to the river Jabbok, He was on the far side of the river. His brother was on the near side. And that night, all of his doubts, all of his lack of courage, all of his uncertainty assailed him. And he wrestled the long night with the angel of his own insecurity, the angel each of us has at some time or other wrestled with in the silence of our room, on our beds. And he was not overcome. And he crossed the river the next morning. He took his life in his hands. He committed himself to what he knew he had to do, and he did it. How often do we have the courage, the gut, the will, do what we know needs to be done, between doing as we have always done and striking out as we sometimes think we should do, we follow the familiar path. What gave Jacob the courage to be Israel? Faith. Faith in himself and faith in his God. He had heard the call to return. He knew he had to return. It seems to me that in 1970, the congregation, all congregations, our congregation, must confront against the meaning of faith for the individual. We have talked of faith collectively. We have the collective exercises of our religious tradition. But there is very little of personal encounter within our synagogues, very little time in which the individual faces himself and faces his God in the quiet of the sanctuary, in discussion with a religious leader, in discussion with others also seeking their way. We have spoken much. Now is the time to listen. We have had religion performed for us. Now, I believe, is the time when each of us must, in a sense, be creative of the faith. Do it themselves. Find their own ways towards God. Four times in the history of this congregation, we've had to take stock, to encounter our tradition, to encounter our times, and to ask ourselves, whence now? Where are we going? Whither? We did so at the moment of the founding of this congregation. We said, we must encounter the day. We can no longer do things simply because they have always been done this way. We want a worship which is meaningful in our idiom. We want ideas which can be translated to our children, hence reform. And then some 50 years later, we again had to encounter ourselves in our tradition, this time not in terms of reform, but in terms of a vague kind of humanism, of liberalism, a naive optimism which had seeped through into this congregation as into all congregations. There was the middle class in America. There was the open frontier. There was the Rotarian spirit. Everyone seemed to be getting along with everybody else. Why did we need the particular? Why did we need that which was uniquely Jewish? Why did we need to talk of the people of Israel? Wasn't this the time to allow the troops to join in one great and grand army of those who believed in America and in freedom and in justice, and you know the litany. This congregation had a great battle in the early 1900s. Some in the congregation said, let's take the Torah from the Ark. Let's take the Hebrew from the prayer book. Let's take the holidays and put them on Sunday. Let's become like unto our neighbors. And others said, hold on now. This is not yet utopia. Kishinev has taken place in the pogroms in Eastern Europe. The poison of anti-Semitism is still real. We talk of cultural pluralism. Let's believe in it. There is nothing that denies us joining with other men in our tradition, but it's our tradition. It encourages and warms us. And Hebrew was kept in our worship, and the Torah was kept in our ark. And of all things, in 1917, the congregation hired a Zionist rabbi who brought Hebrew back into the schools. A third time in the late 1920s, this congregation encountered its times and encountered itself. There was now the mood in the nation that a congregation ought to be a place simply where Jews can meet and can mingle. It doesn't matter what they do in a synagogue as long as they come to the synagogue. All I really want out of Judaism is that my daughter should marry a Jewish boy. And as a result, this congregation took stock, and for a year or two they assessed their activities, and what is now our social hall ceased to be a gymnasium, and what is now our museum ceased to be written as a room which was set aside to be a swimming pool. And the focus of the congregation was centered again on Torah and on Avoda, on study and on worship, on the legitimate business of a religious institution. And now in the 1970s, we must encounter our tradition in ourselves again, I believe. For something strange and new has come over this people, Israel, and its American diaspora. We can no longer take the sense of collectivity for granted. We can no longer assume that as a congregation, people will assemble and perform the rites of the tradition and be satisfied with this kind of collective ritual. Now it is man and his God, man and his destiny. Each of us is trying spiritually as well as politically and personally to do his thing, the young perhaps more than we. But all of us have been infected with this individualism. And the congregations must respond, not by abandoning the collective activities of a congregation, but by allowing individuals more and more role in creating the terms in which these collective activities will take place. The way in which we organize this worship was not ordained to God, to Moses, by God on Mount Sinai. It is the result of time and circumstance, of reform and the 19th century. Well, this is the 20th century, and we have other needs. And what we must find is your gift of spirit, of time, of involvement, of commitment. You must help, you must make the forms of religious life in the future. We will not cut the ties. We must remain within the mainstream of our Jewish tradition. We have responsibilities to this people, Israel, which transcend anything that we do here in this congregation. But we have responsibilities to ourselves, to find new ways of teaching, and new ways of listening, new ways of celebrating our holidays and worship, new ways of involving ourselves more intimately in the holidays and in the worship. The congregations have done much. Now is the time for the individuals within the congregation to do much. We have had professionalism. Now we must have a true democracy of spiritual commitment. 1970. The end of 120 years, the beginning, God willing, of another 120. They will not be easy years. This congregation has lived through the three most bloody wars in the history of mankind. We have lived through the most bloody decades in the history of this people, Israel. We have been remarkably untouched. And if the 1970s will have any meaning, it is that our security has disappeared. We have been caught up in the vortex of history. There is no longer a Cleveland in mid-America, far away from all else that's happening for evil, for danger in the world. We must learn to live with danger and learn to live with insecurity. And learn to encounter this tradition, not superficially, not purely ritually, but to open our hearts to it, to listen to it, to respond to it, as individuals, as men, as women, as Jews. As much to teach, as much as it's ever had to teach, but it cannot be taught by me. You must learn it. You must be willing to turn to it. You must be willing to open your souls to it, to encounter it, You're here to help, to present, to offer, to interpret, to listen. Come not to learn, but to encounter. May God establish the work of our hands. Yea, may they establish this congregation securely in meaning and holy purpose. Amen.